From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to prove the existence of Bigfoot, of a Sasquatch creature. There haven't been any bodies found, or bones either, no skin, no conclusive DNA evidence. But there are footprints, lots and lots of footprints, and for the scientist Jeff Meldrum, that's pretty good evidence. Meldrum is an associate professor of anthropology and anatomy at Idaho State University, and his area of expertise is the study of human locomotor adaptations, which is to say the way primates evolved to move, in particular the primates that ended up on 2 feet. Meldrum includes a Sasquatch figure in his theories, and he's taken his share of flack for it, but he's determined to sift through all the controversy and apply some objective science to this legend. Today in the program, Meldrum will join us to talk about what it means to study a creature we're not even sure exists, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about cryptozoology. Basically, this is the study of hidden animals, the research into creatures whose existence hasn't been proven. To be honest, though, the conversation is going to focus around one of those creatures in particular, Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, and the possibility that a giant ape-like human creature could have survived the Pleistocene in his roaming in the northwest forests of North America. Our guest today is the Professor Jeff Meldrum. He's an associate professor at Idaho State University, and he's determined to sift through the novelty and the controversy and to apply some objective science to this legend. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from you on Facebook or on Twitter. Jeff Meldrum is an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He's also a research associate at the Idaho Museum of Natural History. And he's in Utah presenting a lecture on Sasquatch this evening at Utah Valley University. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. But Jeff Meldrum, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to begin by getting at your own personal interest in all of this. In your book, you write about the fact that when you were younger, quite young, you had a fascination with dinosaurs, but also with prehistoric ape men. And you talk about how you had read Jack London. Most of us read Call of the Wild, but you were more fascinated by his novel Before Adam,
right?
Which may explain some of that. Talk about that.
Well, the notion of how we came to be as we are from a strictly secular perspective,
sure,
from a scientific perspective, always fascinated me, and I was intrigued by it's almost like looking in the in some ways, looking in that funhouse mirror to see humanity sort of presented in a somewhat distorted way, but a very familiar and reminiscent portrayal of our own biology in the form of the great apes. I mean, I think this is why the ape house is always one of the most attractive areas at the zoo.
Why? Because we see some connection there?
I think so. Yeah. I think we see our own behaviors reflected a little differently.
Absolutely.
But it's that hint of humanity, that degree of sentience and intelligence, and that cognitive connection when you look into the eyes of a great ape that has always fascinated me.
But then there's also, and throughout Western history, there's also been resistance to that idea that there was any connection at all.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I'm wondering if you had any sort of religious instruction or if anyone, or if you've confronted this, because this seems to be in some ways this is at the heart of the resistance of any idea of evolution, for example, at least among some religious people. And I'm wondering if you saw that as well, that you didn't seem to have been freaked out by the fact that we may be connected to the apes.
Oh, no, not at all. And it was very natural for me to sort of separate the notions of a spiritual origin of humanity from our biological and our physical origins. And for some people, that those two can't be separated. Yeah. But I think that's what science is about. I mean, it doesn't answer the why questions as to why we're here, the purpose of life. But it certainly addresses the mechanisms, the modus operandi, if you will, yeah. From a creationist's point of view. But certainly that's another facet of my academic career that has been also controversial, because as a practicing Latter-day Saint, my own religious convictions about those aspects of our origins do sometimes abut. And give me a very unique perspective too, because obviously from a purely demographic perspective, you know, the population, the student population at Idaho State University is largely reflective of some of those religious persuasions. And so I'm often approached by students asking how it is that I reconcile what they think is Mormon doctrine with my what I'm teaching in my course on organic evolution.
And then, of course, there's the resistance that you get from fellow academics, which is another thing entirely. But let me ask you this, though. Do you think that it seems like there are two aspects to this kind of resistance, which we'll get at as we go along, to the idea of there being a Bigfoot figure? I mean, on one hand, do you think it has something to do with resistance to this idea that there may be a human-like creature still existing, a little too close for comfort?
Well, I don't get that sense from the academic community.
No, of course not. That's the other side. No, right. Well, which we'll get to that.
All right.
But do you think that's part of the resistance?
Well, I have had letters from individuals with very fundamentalist persuasions who clearly convey an uneasiness about this, that this is some plot to bolster evolutionary biology by identifying or proposing a missing link that would vindicate the evolutionary theory, but that's a pretty minor or a minority point of view, I think.
You write about how when you were 11, you went and saw this documentary about America's Abominable Snowman.
Right.
And there's this very famous piece of film, which we'll talk to, because you kind of break it down in your career. You have the 60 seconds of footage from these two men named Robert – is it Gimlin?
Yes, Bob Gimlin and
Roger Patterson. This was taken in the mountains of Northern California in 1967. This, you know, and I bet everyone who's listening has seen this footage, this large ape-like creature striding across this looking back.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it.
Right.
And it made a huge impression on you when you were a kid.
Well, it did. I mean, it certainly the fascination I had with mysteries, with unexplained phenomenon, with prehistoric man and human evolution all seemed to sort of converge on the screen right there as the prospect of the very figure that would fit into that void, that big question mark. I mean, I think that the notion has been frequently proposed that this is some sort of missing link. I don't think that's the case. That's right. Not the conclusions I've drawn from the evidence to date. But the nature of the creature, if in fact this species does exist, is certainly one that's hotly contested amongst Bigfoot enthusiasts and advocates and sometimes on thin evidence and personal experience as opposed to more empirical observations.
But how much did the idea of the legend of a Bigfoot, or the, you know, really kind of thrilling prospect that it could be real, how much did that drive your interest in, you know, what you eventually studied, the way primates, the way humans evolved to move?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And I don't know that I can honestly pin that down, whether how much of it was overt and how much of it was subliminal.
Yeah.
I mean, whether the one was fascinating because of the underlying interest, or that the viewing the film actually steeled that conviction or that fascination with the questions that surrounded the possible existence and how one might go about evaluating those evidences.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, you know, all kinds of things plug into sure. what we eventually become, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's fair to say that it wasn't the principal thing in your mind. Like, you didn't go, I'm going to go out and prove the existence of Bigfoot. That wasn't
oh,
what
no,
it was.
No. Yeah. And that youthful interest and enthusiasm waxed and waned throughout my life in you know, various stages of my academic career and as I lived in various places in the United States pursuing my education and early career. And it wasn't until I was back in the Pacific Northwest and the Intermountain West and was confronted with some evidence that things sort of came full circle almost. Mm. And, you know, I don't believe in fate, but there certainly seemed to be a lot of things that sort of laid themselves out before me that have opened up opportunities to pursue this subject in a way that I might not have been afforded if I had gone down another path.
What was it that interested you? I mean, before the Sasquatch stuff that you started looking into in more particular ways, mm-hmm. I mean, you were looking at the way we evolved to move, how we move. I mean, mm-hmm. what in particular were you interested in exactly?
Well, I was always fascinated with human anatomy, with the marvelous machine that the human body is and the various contrivances that we have for our daily activities and so on. And also the remarkable resemblances we share with other primates.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the field of physical anthropology, there sort of was a dichotomy. You either studied dietary adaptations and the mechanics and morphology of the jaws and teeth, or you were interested in the way animals got about, whether to avoid predation or to find and forage for food items. And that was the postcranial anatomy. And for some reason, I gravitated to that. I was interested in the way we evolved, and particularly our unique adaptations for walking on two legs that set us off from you know all other primates and most mammals.
Yeah.
And you know whether the notion of another creature having evolved that in parallel and possibly existing today was somewhere in the shadows
sure.
in the background of that that interest that could very well be.
And then you meet at some point in this sort of continuum, a fellow by the name of Grover Krantz.
That's right.
One of the few anthropologists who offered to sort of have a critical look at all of this.
That's right.
Talk about meeting him and what kind of influence he had on mm-hmm. the direction then of your career.
Well, Grover had something of a reputation for often taking unorthodox approaches to controversial questions, and his fascination and interest with Sasquatch was just part of that persona.
What do you mean, like unwilling to take at face value all the skepticism? Like, I am my own person. I'm going to check this out myself.
That's right.
Yeah.
He often had I was quite interested to learn much more about his career when commemorative event following his retirement was held. And as his students portrayed many of the somewhat forward-looking and at the time controversial hypotheses that he put forward, which eventually to varying degrees bore out as more evidence came to light. And the question of Sasquatch was one of those where likewise he wasn't beholden to the prevailing paradigm but was determined to follow the evidence and to think innovatively and critically on all fronts. And that was always impressive to me. And his background in physical anthropology kind of dovetailed with many of the interests that I was already cultivating. Mm-hmm. And so his approach to the question of Sasquatch focused on aspects of footprints and foot mechanics that might explain the particulars and the adaptations of a very large bipedal primate. So in many ways, I've sort of picked up where he left off.
Yeah.
And given my more focused attention to both theoretical and empirical bases of those aspects, those types of questions, I think I've been able to even push many of these issues further down the pike and brought them to the attention of the scientific community in various ways by presentations at professional meetings and publications.
Yeah.
For example, we've assigned an ichnotaxonomic nomen to the footprints, which is now formally and officially in a peer-reviewed article, published a scientific name that puts a label, a handle on these footprints and establishes a diagnosis. What are the distinguishing characteristics? Hmm. And that provides a basis for further discussion. Yeah. I mean, it brings it to the attention of the scientific community.
I want to get at some of these footprints, and I want to talk about an experience you had, because the first time you saw an actual track, you saw certain distinctive things. There's something mm-hmm. you say in your book which is intriguing. You say – and I want you to sort of take us to that moment though, because you say okay. when you saw this print or this particular print, there was a series of prints, mm-hmm. you saw something that was what was the term you used? Animated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But take us to that moment first, because right. the first experience you had with actually seeing right. tracks, it was associated with a man by the name of Paul Freeman.
That's right. I had learned about Paul Freeman, and he actually a number of his artifacts figured rather prominently in Grover Krantz's analyses, right. So we had I had been asked to write a book review of a little booklet that was published by a regional journalist that featured many of the discoveries and the exploits of this Paul Freeman, and it was a fascinating read. And so in the process of writing that review, I arranged to visit him. As it turned out, we were in the area – my brother and I were in the area yeah. Several weeks earlier than we had intended, and so we paid a surprise visit and caught him, I'm quite confident, totally unawares. But as it turned out, serendipitously, he claimed that he had just found some footprints that morning. He had the habit of running the roads, which were largely unimproved dirt roads, so great potential track beds right. in the early spring as the snow had melted off. And he had just found some tracks that morning. And
now, what are you feeling right now when he said, come on, let's go see this? You're is it skeptical?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I just thought, oh, come on. Yeah. What a coincidence.
Yeah.
Did you find out we were going to come after all?
right.
And I kind of looked at my brother and I said, well, what have we got to lose? We're here. Let's take a look. So we drove up into the foothills and parked the truck, climbed out, and sure enough, here's this long line of tracks on this farm access road, very silt-laden, so very fine substrate. Tracks are remarkably clear, unmistakable. I mean, there's no room for misidentification. Either these are hoaxed, very cleverly hoaxed, or these are the real thing. And in fact, I comment that there's a certain sensation, and the only thing I can compare it to is like the first time that I really hefted a fossil, and you have the realization that you're holding the remains of what was a living creature, but yeah. millions of years ago. And it's like it's almost like, you know, stepping into a time machine in a way. And that sensation kind of raised the hair on the back of my neck, because the realization set in that, my gosh, you know, a Sasquatch actually could have walked right by here. Before that, it was always kind of abstract. I mean, it's this notion yeah. that they could exist.
Sure.
But then when you see these tracks and you recognize the animation, and I think, you know, for people who are not familiar with footprints and don't know how to read and interpret that sign, that may not sound significant, or they may not appreciate that sensation. But when you can see those details, I mean, to the point that you, in your mind's eye, you can literally visualize the creature, or at least the foot, and the anatomy that was required to leave that imprint and to produce the dynamic features that were present there that indicate that this was more than just a artificial contrivance stamped into the mud.
Well, you know, it's interesting because people say, well, there's no hard evidence. But for a person who studies footprints, mm-hmm. that's about as good evidence as it gets. And there's this particular moment you talk about, seeing one track footprint in particular, mm-hmm. where the heel isn't present.
Right.
But what gave you a sense that there was something spontaneous and, as you say, animated in
right.
that. And that told you what? There was some flexibility there. There was something you
Absolutely.
Saw in that print.
Right. And that print and there were other full prints where the heel was there, but there was this unusual artifact right across the midfoot where the soil had been pushed up in what's called a pressure release ridge. So in other words, as pressure was transferred from one part of the foot to another, concentrated into an area, sometimes the substrate will yield in particular ways. Then, and as you pointed out, there were these what I've called half tracks, yeah. were just the fore part of the foot, not just the ball. I mean, if you or I were to go sprinting down the beach at full tilt, we would leave these very abbreviated tracks where just the ball and heads of the metatarsals, the the short bones there in the fore part of the foot. As the result of having a longitudinal arch, we can balance up on the ball of the foot.
Right.
This creature seems to have a much more primitive, a more ape-like configuration of the joints or a range of motion in those joints that allows the foot to flex. And there's some aspects of the mechanics involved there that are elegantly adapted to this habitat that they occupy. But the only way
But different from us. I mean,
but exactly.
Because we, as you've written about in your book, you say, you know, that humans, okay, so we evolved in different terrain on plains,
yes.
endurance walking and hunting and those kinds of things.
Exactly.
But if you've got a creature that evolves in forested terrain, lots of climbing up,
exactly.
I would say elevation, steep elevations.
Steep hillsides and mountainsides.
That sort of creature, what you saw in that footprint, was it evolved in a different kind of
That's
way.
That's right. That's what it would seem, yeah. And but yet similar, we're learning more about the early hominid adaptations. This has been another theme in my more, quote, orthodox research into the evolution of the human foot, that this adaptation of walking on very flat but flexible feet is actually the initial adaptation of early hominids, and that our modern human form of walking on a foot that has this fixed longitudinal arch is a very recent innovation. And I've taken flack for that hypothesis as well, but there's growing recognition as more skeletal elements verify and bear out my interpretation of the fossilized footprints that indeed the foot has evolved these characteristics in a very mosaic and very protracted pattern over many millions of years. The first bipeds didn't walk around like little humans with short legs. They had a very different style of gait and nature of step with a very flat, flexible foot. So these Sasquatch tracks seem to exhibit that very characteristic. So they're not simply enlargements of human footprints. You know, somebody using a modern human foot as an example, but just making it bigger and it maybe even wider. There are other aspects in the proportions and in the dynamic features that show up that suggest that this is a very distinct morphology, and yet not just random. I mean, it's exactly what you might expect in an animal that walks on two legs, that has a large body mass, and that frequents this terrain with very steep, rugged terrain, broken terrain that requires this greater degree of prehension in the foot and flexibility to navigate through those obstacles.
At that point, Jeff Meldrum, did you figure, all right, I'm in? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did that say, okay, no, I think. And I'm wondering if you had doubts up until that point, you thought, this is it. Was that a kind of a clincher for you?
It was. It really was. And I can, you know, even remember that going through that thought process as I'm sitting here. You know, after we took Paul Freeman back and dropped him off, and I turned to my brother and I said, look, even if these are hoaxed, there's some things we can learn from this case study. Let's go. We had to chase down some materials on a Sunday afternoon, find a hardware store that was open, went back up there. And then it was the head scratcher. You know, I sat there contemplating, and I remember having that fork in the road. Do I go down this path? Because I knew some of the grief that Dr. Krantz had endured in his career as a result of his preoccupation with this. And I thought, do I want to commit to that pathway or not? Or is this just an interesting weekend and we'll chalk it up to to nothing more than that? And it just hit me. I've got to pursue this. I mean, this is fascinating. This, I think, and that was, I guess, the impact of this particular event, that I was confronted with a set of tracks, a rare opportunity, very rare opportunity, where there was a remarkable number of sequential footprints, you know, 45 tracks on all probably, that were remarkably clear. And so, as I said, there was no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
These were either hoax or they were the real thing. And I tell you, the evidence clearly tipped the scale in the affirmative direction in my mind. And that was when I thought and resolved, I'm going to have to follow this and come what may.
Well, come what may. I mean, you've gotten, you've taken some flack for all of this, of course, over the – I wonder if you've ever regretted it, though, to that point where maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah. Well, there have been moments when those thoughts have crossed my mind, and I've sometimes pondered what my career path would have been had I not followed this this line of inquiry. But I tell you, the process has been fascinating. I mean, it's been – it has provided, I think, too, very important and fresh perspectives on many aspects of human locomotor evolution that have served to invigorate the discussion and prevent what I'm quite confident would otherwise be a prevailing paradigm that I think is flawed, is absolutely flawed. And so the perceptions of the timing and pattern of the emergence of our adaptations for walking would have been misdirected for quite some time, given the sparsity of the fossil record of that part of hominid anatomy, particularly the foot skeleton. Mm. And so the insights that I've gained by contemplating how this creature would have or has evolved and adapted to its form of locomotion have caused me to look more critically at certain assumptions that have been made about the way in which modern human evolution, modern human locomotor evolution, yeah, has progressed. So I've been, in a way, sort of a thorn in the side of those that would advocate a different interpretation, and like I said, that's engendered dialogue, and that's healthy in science. I mean, when there's if there aren't opposing views to prevailing hypotheses, and assuming those opposing views have merit and have evidence to bolster them, or they're based upon objective and credible observations, things tend to kind of stagnate, and consensus seems to prevail unchallenged.
So for good or ill, you're in.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That was the decision. Jeff that's Meldrum right. is with us. He's an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He's presenting a lecture on the legend and science of Sasquatch tonight at 6 p.m. at the Utah Valley University Library. You can find more information about that event and some links to Jeff Meldrum's research on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking with the Professor Jeff Meldrum, Associate Professor of Anatomy and Anthropology at Idaho State University. We're talking to him because he's in town giving a lecture on the legend and science of Sasquatch tonight at 6 o'clock. Giving us an opportunity to talk about his work and about cryptozoology. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You write about when you were first thinking about all of this, you didn't feel, pressured or indoctrinated by either side. In those early days, you were just sort of thinking about all of this. Mm-hmm. You've talked about the fact, the idea often comes down to, is he a believer or a non-believer? Mm-hmm. Is this person a believer or a non-believer in a Bigfoot? You don't like the word belief or believe in this context.
Right, I don't. And when asked that question by a journalist, I often launch into a little sermonette about the nature of positions of faith, which rely on convictions in the absence of definitive proof.
Yeah.
And my interest in this rests on conclusions drawn, at least tentative conclusions, drawn on the basis of evidence. And, in skeptical, in ideological skeptical circles, true believer is a very pejorative and derogatory label that
sure.
is put on anyone who entertains such a notion yeah. that such a thing could
exist.
Because
it's faith. It's faith in something, and it doesn't have any basis in
right.
fact.
Right.
That's where you are, right, is the idea of you want the evidence.
Well, exactly. And so, even in my own department, I've had comments get back to me that where colleagues have said, oh, well, he believes in that, so he's no longer objective. So if you succumb to that label, then your pigeonholed as being no longer capable even of conducting objective critical science. And so, sure, I avoid that. And, whatever my personal conclusions are on the basis of this evidence, that's really kind of irrelevant. I mean, obviously, I have quite a bit of confidence in where the evidence is pointing. Otherwise, I wouldn't continue to pursue it. But sure. That's true for any scientist. They always exhibit a certain amount of confidence or doubt about a hypothesis that they're attempting to either validate or to refute. So, yeah.
But it's interesting. When did this become a taboo? You know, when did it become something that like, you're crazy, you believe in Bigfoot? I mean, yeah. When did that happen? That there would be the existence of a hominid or an ape-like figure, and there seems to be some kind of evidence, not conclusive evidence, but some evidence. Right. When did that become such a taboo? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. I certainly it was the prevalent notion when Grover Krantz, I mean, he was pursuing this question. And so from very early on, it was perceived as being pseudoscience, yeah, or tabloid. I mean, when Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin came out of the woods with this film clip and it was shown to scientists, you know, they couldn't really quite point out the zipper, but they weren't ready to acknowledge that this was the real thing. And in that aloofness, in that pulling back into the void that created, then sprang up all of the fortune seekers and adventurers and amateur enthusiasts who have then kind of carried on the torch in a way, while scientists stood back, with very few exceptions,
yeah,
Grover being one. It was interesting that as the history of the interest in the Himalayan Yeti becomes more and more understood, there were a lot of scientists at that time who behind the scenes were quite enthusiastic about the research and the possibility of such a species existing, very prominent anthropologists and primatologists, and yet they did not make that interest known publicly at all. So what I find fascinating is that while the search for the Yeti and the search for the Sasquatch has been trudging on with you know, whatever cadre of proponents adhere themselves to it, the scientific community has begun this march that is – or this this vector that is now converging in a way, because as
– So they're coming back.
Well, more openly. I mean the prevailing paradigm in anthropology in the 70s, for example, there was this notion of a single species hypothesis. Yeah. The idea that the hominid niche was so unique there could be only one species occupying it. That began to crumble when the Leakeys began to discover multiple,
yeah,
contemporaneous hominids. Well, over the decades, that family tree of our hominid ancestors gets bushier and bushier and bushier with every annual discovery, it, yeah, seems. And on top of that, the persistency, the recent persistency of many of those branches on that bush become come closer and closer and closer to modern times. So we have a specimen of presumably Homo heidelbergensis from found outside of Beijing that could be only 12,000 years old.
Wow.
We have Homo floresiensis, the hobbit, which caused quite a stir with the NIST discovery, only 18,000 years old, its fossils. We have the announcement of a recent discovery of a Neanderthal site in Siberia that dates to only 10 to 20,000 years old. These are just, you know, a wink of the eye in terms of geologic time and archaeological time. And so the idea that there could be some relic populations of any number of hominids or apes or hominoids persisting in remote corners isn't so fantastic anymore. It isn't necessarily just the stuff of tabloid, supermarket rags, but it's being discussed in scientific circles at anthropological meetings.
You know, it seems – I wonder what in particular about cryptozoology, it seems like that the field uses in a unique way some of the legends, some of the traditions from different cultures. Mm-hmm. That seems an important way. But I guess how do you balance – what might be perceived as, you know, silly, superstitious legends, mm-hmm, with what might be some sort of, you know, stylized truth there.
Well, exactly. In fact, one of the slides I'm going to show tonight has a phrase that I picked up from a colleague. No history is without myth, yet no myth is without history. And so there is this intertwining of the two. And in fact, we would expect that. If you look at something like the unfolding of the discovery of the gorilla, it's interesting when you first – the first portrayals and representations of the legends of these giant hairy apes – well, not that giant, but these hairy man-like creatures in the jungles of Africa, which then eventually kind of – once they're discovered, once we start observing them, we go from Gargantua, the most terrifying creature on the earth as billed by Barnum and Bailey, to the gentle giants. And now – mountain gorillas is the poster child, the species on the brink of extinction that represents these shrinking tropical forests. And so our perception is interwoven with that kind of legendary mystique gradually tempered by scientific observation and understanding.
So many different legends sort of attach themselves to all of this. Let me read an email from mm-hmm. Ben, who writes in Murray. I heard a story that Bigfoot once told somebody he was Cain, Abel's brother. What do you know about that? We talked a little bit about that off the air. You said it's a kind of a Mormon folklore, I guess.
That's right. There was a returning pioneer missionary, David Patton, who claimed that as he was sitting astride his mule, he suddenly noticed walking beside him this hairy figure who identified himself as Cain, who was cursed to wander the face of the earth seeking the destruction of human souls, whereupon David raised his arm to the square and rebuked this entity, and off he went. Wow. And somehow this – unfortunately, this has been perpetuated in Mormon literature, and invariably I'm asked this same question. I'm afraid I have to say that I think that this story has absolutely nothing to do with Bigfoot. there have been some great novels that have been written on this theme.
This doesn't help. This can't help you. I mean, no. The so-called monster media, some of these theories, some of these, that must be one of the obstacles to you getting, your colleagues to pay attention is real science.
Oh, sure.
It seems so tawdry.
Right, and that has been one of the biggest challenges, is to try to transfer this question from the tabloid to the realm of a simple, straightforward biological question: is there a species behind this legend? You know, is there some history behind the myth? And incrementally, I think that a great deal has been accomplished in that. I mean, Grover kept the door open as one of the sole advocates for research into this question, and I have managed to present papers at professional meetings and now publish papers. My book has received rave reviews from some very prominent luminaries such as Jane Goodall and George Schaller and Russell Mittermeier. I mean, these are people whose opinions carry a tremendous amount of weight, not advocating that Sasquatch exists.
No,
or that
they
believe.
Somebody should look at it.
Exactly, that the question is justified as a line of research, and in fact it begs that we pay attention to it given the current circumstances and the evidence that lies before us.
This idea of evidence, of course, this always comes up, and I wanted you to talk a bit about it, because this seems to get at what might be the nature of such a creature, if such a creature exists. Mm-hmm. This idea that there's no hard evidence that can be – although we talked about footprints, but let's mm-hmm. – no bones, no skin, no conclusive DNA analysis from hairs, no conclusive photograph, although we did talk about that film. I mean, what do you make of that? This idea that, look, I'll believe it, and you hear this from skeptics all the time, when you show me a body.
That's right. Yeah, show me the body. Well, I'm the first to acknowledge the scientific community is under no obligation to recognize the existence of a species without the type specimen. And that having been said and acknowledged, that doesn't excuse the scientific community from looking askance from any of the evidence that suggests that for whatever reason or bias or prejudice that might influence that. We have something. I mean, it boils down to this. Something is leaving footprints. Something is shedding hair that cannot be attributed to any known species, although it has been challenging to extract DNA from it, yeah. given the, just the nature of the hair by chance. You know, we have scat. We have signs of the presence of a large animal. We have these eyewitness accounts, admittedly, many of which can be discounted as misidentification, imagination, and so forth. But, I mean, when you're sitting across the table from a trained observer, an outdoorsman who has spent many, many days in the forest in their career, in their occupation, their avocation, and they've seen something in broad daylight, at short distance, unobstructed view of a creature, it's hard to simply say, well, you're probably just mistaken. You know, you're misidentifying some other animal, or you're lying. You know, you have to take some of that into account. The growing number of snippets of photographs. I mean, there's an interesting project on Facebook called Facebook Find Bigfoot, where individuals are invited to post their little clips and snapshots. I mean, one of the criticisms has been, in this day and age of cell phone cameras and handheld video cameras, why aren't there more pictures? Well, actually, there's quite a few. The problem is most people, and especially under these circumstances, are simply lousy photographers. And so the result is any one of which taken alone, you'd probably just dismiss it. But when you start lining them up one after the other, there's some remarkable consistency that suggests, you know, that maybe some of these people really are capturing snapshots, glimpses of an unrecognized creature.
Jeff Meldrum is with us, an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He's giving a lecture on the legend and science of Sasquatch tonight at Utah Valley University at 6 o'clock at the library there. You can find more information about the event and some links to Jeff Meldrum's research, as well as that 1967 film footage, which we've been talking about, at KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Professor Jeff Meldrum, an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. We're talking to him because he's in town giving a lecture at Utah Valley University tonight at the library there on the legend and science of Sasquatch. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. John has been waiting in Salt Lake. John, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
You had mentioned that the Patterson tape had affected you as it did me when I was a child. And, you know, I'd seen experts look at the tape and say that it couldn't be a hoax because the Sasquatch was a female and, you know, it just looked totally real to me. And then after he died, I think it was his kids came out and said that it was a hoax. And I just wanted to know what you felt about that.
Right.
No, wasn't Patterson or – it was another fellow, Wallace. Is that right?
Right. It was – and this is one of the problems is that these two stories keep getting conflated in the journalistic coverage and the story of Ray Wallace and the story of Roger Patterson. Roger never recanted his story. And, in fact, his partner, Bob Gimlin, I count as a very close friend now. And you can't spend 5 minutes with Bob and not be absolutely convinced that he's the straightest arrow.
He's still alive.
Yeah, he is.
Huh.
He's the straightest arrow you'll ever meet. And when you listen to him recount the story, what happened was when Wallace passed away, you know, basically his family – Wallace had a penchant for all kinds of shenanigans, and he fabricated so-called Bigfoot casts and other paraphernalia, which he peddled at a roadside curio shop. And so when he passed away, his family was left with this garage full of all these odd and unusual artifacts, including these carved wooden feet. And so they came out suggesting that all of the Sasquatch footprints were made by these. And I my first response, I got on the phone and talked to Mike Wallace, his son, who was acting as spokesman for the family, and said, you know, could we please come and document these? It'd be a very straightforward exercise to validate your claims, to demonstrate whether these feet are responsible for any of the documented footprints that were photographed and cast throughout that time period. Well, you know, and one excuse after another. There was a book deal in the works. They were going to make a movie about Dad and this, that, or the other. I said, well, what about these innuendos that it was your mom in the fursuit that Roger filmed. And he says, oh, no, we didn't have, you know, they took some films of Mrs. Wallace in a fursuit. Mrs. Wallace is barely 5 feet tall. but no, we had nothing to do. He says, although I'm sure it was a hoax, we had nothing to do with the Patterson film. Well, of course, as soon as interest began to wane, the next thing you see is the Wallaces on camera, and Mrs. Wallace, with a sly little grin on her face, is saying that, yes, she was the woman, she was the person in the fursuit, referring to the Patterson film. And Mike Wallace echoing that same thing, that yes, that his dad had actually set that up for Roger to film. So the claims that the Wallaces were responsible, not a single footprint can be attributed, convincingly attributed to the artificial feet that they have publicized, the few ones, and which are very crude carvings and static, stiff planks of wood. So I'm always intrigued that so many people and how the skeptics are so eager to glom onto what they see as a very simple, straightforward explanation for what's a very complex and complicated situation. And if they would take the time to look and research the claims of these pretenders and these claimants to the hoaxes, in many instances, they just evaporate under scrutiny.
You're not suggesting that there aren't hoaxes. I mean, I think you've said this. You know there are. But the evidence in that particular film, you find pretty compelling.
Well, I do. If on no basis even than the footprints that were associated with that incident. In fact, the footprints.
So there were castings from
that. Right. Yeah. Roger cast a right and a left, and then the site was visited by several other investigators. One was Bob Titmus, who cast a series of 10 successive footprints. A timber cruiser in the area, Lyle Laverty, is a prominent figure in the U.S. Forest Service and now in the Colorado Parks Department was on the site shortly after and snapped photographs of a number of the footprints, and they exhibit these aspects of the dynamics. I mean, they're remarkably clear footprints given the nature of the substrate. But when you combine that with the anatomy that is evident on the film, and people need to realize that oftentimes the broadcast version of the film that they see on the TV screen is not of a very high quality. And I've been afforded the opportunity to examine much, much clearer versions, cleaner copies of that film, some that have been enhanced through color splitting and so forth that reveal details of the anatomy, action of muscle groups. And you can actually see the contraction of muscles at the appropriate time. I mean, things that just would not be conceivable in a fur suit, especially one circa 1967, when state of the art was on display in the movie theaters in the form of the original Planet of the Apes.
Right. I wanted to. You had your own excursion in that, not far, in fact, from this particular area where this was filmed, in the wilderness of Northern California, and you write about it in your book. You and a companion, a guide, Mark Slack was his name. You went into the wilderness, and you had these kind of amazing experiences where you had Mark's backpack was rifled through a couple of times. Yeah. You heard vocalizations. What do you make of what this creature is? Are they curious? Mm-hmm. Are they violent? I mean, what did you learn from that experience, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, I think you hit on one aspect, and if this is a higher primate with an intelligence at least on the order of a chimp or a gorilla, then I think when it comes to human contacts, that there is this tension where they're curious on the one hand, but yet they know they need to be and they've evolved to remain elusive, to avoid human contact. Humans as a potential threat, as most wild animals have come to behave. And so, yes, I think the sights and smells and sounds of a human encampment are enticing, draw them in. I think that's why we have lots of sightings of them peering into cabin windows at night to see what's going on in this lit box where these funny hairless creatures are going about their evening activities. But on the other hand, like I said, I think that they have evolved a behavior of elusivity in order to avoid human contact, in order to have survived the way they have.
You think they're long-lived, mm-hmm. That they don't reproduce very often.
Right. These are assumptions, extrapolating from the idea that this is a large primate. And so being, for the most part, solitary, most sightings and most footprint finds are single individuals or what we interpret as females with offspring. As you said, long-lived. So that, a chimpanzee, the longest, I think it was the Gorgeous here in the Hogel Zoo in Salt Lake, lived to be about 52 years old. And so since there's some correlation with longevity and body size, a larger animal may live a bit longer. So a half century in the wild for a Sasquatch probably isn't inconceivable at all. Reproducing frequently, orangutans, a female may give birth to 4 offspring in her lifetime, and they invest heavily in the upbringing, slow development of those offspring. So a death is probably a rare event. And this kind of goes back to, your question about where are the bones and the skin and so forth, the body. An animal that is at the top of its food chain, has no natural predators, is going to die most often, most frequently, a natural death. So this rare event is going to take place out of the way, as all animals who die natural deaths usually secrete themselves off somewhere. And then the environment very quickly takes care of those remains, be it the biological elements that reduce and recycle the elements, or what might be left, the bits of bone and so forth, exposed to the wet coniferous forests, often with volcanic soils, very acidic soils, are very quickly decomposed and leave little trace.
We've got about a minute left. Let me say we're getting some responses from people who have their own kinds of stories, which I'm sure come up all the time.
Absolutely.
So I invite you to go to our website and share those with us. Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left, little less than that. What are the implications if it's true?
Just simply that there are corners of the globe that are yet unexplored, unfathomed. It's not going to rewrite human history, I don't think. I mean, if it turns out to be what I think it is, which is a species of large ape that's just one more member on that bushy ape or hominid tree, or perhaps an early hominid. I don't think it's another form of human. So it's not going to impact our perceptions of our own history and our place in nature much at all, I think.
Nothing to be afraid of then.
No.
Jeff Meldrum, an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He's presenting a lecture tonight at Utah Valley University on the legend and the science of Sasquatch. That's at 6 o'clock at the library there. Go to our website for the particulars, KUER.org/Radio West. Jeff Meldrum, thank you very much for your time.
Again, thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our producers are Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.